Welcome everyone to the Macro Hive week ahead. We've had a busy week. The Fed have been on the docket. It was an interesting Fed. We'll jump into that in a second. Dom, how are you?
Very well, Ben. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm good now. The Fed's done. It almost feels like it's the time to relax. Perhaps not.
Ah, but we are not done with the Fed. We have 17 speakers this coming week.
Thankfully, that's a bit more of a you job than a me job. But for now, let's talk on the Fed. What's already happened? I mean, from my side, it feels like there were sort of three key updates. One was that, in their view, the risks to employment have risen. The other was inflation risks have picked up, but not persistently. And then the third is that the dots revealed an extra cut. What I'd be really keen to hear from you is, number one, your take on their views for across the economic data, the risk to the outlook, and then thirdly, the fact that they've actually put in another cut in the SEP.
So I see the most important takeaway from this is that Powell refused to commit to cutting cycle. He was asked if he would take decisions still meeting by meeting, and he said yes. And in my view, this reflects two things. One, that the data is ambiguous. The data on growth, for instance. So this week we will get further clue, but we got strong retail sales this week, yet we're seeing the consumer deleverage. So for every positive factor, there is a negative factor. So there is that. And it's hard to, to commit to anything when you don't know when the economy is going. And the other reason why Powell didn't commit to a clear policy direction is I think they disagree on inflation risk. To me, what was interesting was that, as you mentioned, the statement made clear that they see higher risk to employment, but there was nothing about inflation. And yet, during the Q&A, Powell explained that the pass-through of tariff had to inflation had been lower and smaller than what they had expected. So I suspect, and also given the dispersion of the dots, even if you ignore, the six cuts, which was obviously the six cut 2025 dot, which was obviously my runs, the dispersion was more than I expected. You had someone who felt very strongly about not cutting this year, so who put a dot showing no cut, a sort of passive aggressive dissent, if you will. So obviously they are not on the same page. We probably need a couple more data points on inflation to see more of a consensus. So that's the first takeaway. There is they see a great deal of uncertainty on the path of the economy, and they disagree on inflation risk. The second takeaway is that all these personal issues, Myron, Governor Cook, and it's a lot of noise. But the Fed can function very well with a Trump appointee, even someone like Myron, who is coming with a, I guess with a presidential mandate to cut massively. But the thing is, it's only one vote out of 12. I mean, there was in the media this presumption that because Governor Waller and Bauman had been appointed by Trump during his first mandate, that they would line up with Myron. I didn't believe it. And yeah, it's clear that's not what happened. So Myron is just one vote out of 12. And as Powell said during the presser, if he wants to bring the FOMC to his views, he needs to make a convincing case. And honestly, looking at the data, it's hard to make a case for six cuts this year. I think for six cuts, you would either need very clear signs that the economy is sliding into a deep recession. So you need the data to move a lot. Or the other scenario would be that we are going back to the low inflation regime we had before the pandemic, but we will need many more data points that we are going to get over the remainder of the year. The important data on inflation, employment comes out mainly monthly, so it's not possible to make a case for 6 cuts. So I think there's far too much attention given to all those personal issues and not enough attention given to the data. At least that's my view.
And one question on the back of that before we get to the Fed speakers next week, you'll probably give us a better idea as to where people landed on that SEP. So the markets are practically pricing in two cuts into year end. It's 0.9 for October, 1.8 for December. So basically the pricing in two. What does the data have to look like for it to only be one cut slash what does it have to look like for it to be three cuts? As in, it feels like the board is somewhere in between it, and they could do three, they could do one, they could do two.
So
What are you looking at?
it's really about unemployment. As I've said many times, a very fast increase in unemployment is a sign that the economy is sliding into recession. So unemployment, I mean, what was interesting was that the SCP showed one more cut, even though in 2025, even though the forecast for unemployment and inflation was not changed, which means the cut, as Powell explained, was a risk management cut. So if unemployment goes above 4.5% before the December FOMC, it will be a sign that we are headed for recession. And who knows? Myron, six cut scenarios could come into play. I'm not sure about six, but for sure, a couple of prints with unemployment going, say, 20 bips up each time, the Fed will cut more than three time. Less than three time, I mean, higher signs that tariff are creating an inflation problem, which in my view is very unlikely, or suddenly the labor market recovers, unemployment falls, we have an explosion in NFP. Honestly, I see this as a smaller risk than a risk of the economy weaker. Getting weaker. But my model forecast is really the SCP, I think, likely to continue to get slowly moving data, probably in the direction of the economy stabilizing. But let's see. I think it was a good decision overall. Sometimes the data doesn't show you anything clear and you end up doing a risk management and just be very patient with what you do next. And it seems to me that's what the FOMC did.
No, I completely agree. Sometimes you speak to clients, you speak to investors, and they have a dislike for central banks not giving the sort of an outright opinion on forward guidance. But sometimes, they can't. Sometimes the best stance for them is just to go, okay, let's see what the data gives us. If it is weaker ahead, then okay, we need to cut. But if it's not weaker, then perhaps we are doing something right. So I agree with you there, and. Really, I think the next step then for us is to talk about the Fed speakers next week. As we were talking before, there's 17 appearances next week, 13 speakers. First, is there any that stand out? I see Powell's on Tuesday.
So Powell, I mean, Myron is speaking this morning in 1.5 hours. I think he's getting a lot of attention for all the reasons we discussed, but I suspect next week he's more or less going to repeat what he will say this morning. I think this morning he's going to make a pitch for his massive cuts this year. I think he could also mention the branch and root review of the Fed that Secretary Bessent argued for in a Wall Street Journal article 2 weeks ago, possibly. But the data is the data. You can, sing and dance as much as you want. You can't ignore
I mean,
reality.
one question I wanted to ask is, obviously you said earlier, look, if Myron's going to get people on board to do a very dovish sort of cutting view, i.e. to get people in line with his view that the Fed cuts a lot, he needs to basically convince the rest of the board. Well, if he talks later and he does want to get across the view that six cuts is the right amount, what data points would he actually put forward? How would you think he'd actually argue that six is the right answer, or a
I
lot
think he's going to argue that the tariff have no impact on inflation, which is, oh, that's Kevin Hassett who said this one. But he probably is going to take a very extreme view on inflation. And on inflation, again, the Fed position is a reasonable one. I think they are a little too worried, but they are saying, the base case is the tariff will be a one-off price increase, but the risk need to be managed. So that the risk need to be managed is why we can't do the six cut. And then there is a big risk with the six cut, which is that inflation expectation would de-anchor. And one reason the Fed was able to cut and put the two additional cuts this year is, as Powell said during the presser, long-term inflation expectations are rock solid. And they are rock solid because the Fed hiked very fast in 2022-23. Do six cuts now and watch what happens to break evens. But again, it's the data. I think it's Ayn Rand who said you can escape, you can ignore reality, but you cannot ignore the consequences of ignoring reality. I mean, you can't control markets, or at least you cannot now.
And Powell on Tuesday, do you think he's able to, voice more of a personal opinion, or is it would it be much of a sort of a rinse and repeat of the presser?
So it's very rare for Powell not to represent the median view on the FOMC. I think it's just going to expand on the themes of the presser, the risk to employment, the lower than expected, smaller and slower, he said, pass through from tariff to inflation. I don't expect anything new.
Okay, so if we look at the other speakers, I mean, I know one of your favorites is Muzalem. What would you expect there?
So Mousalem is, yeah, I like him because he's an economist. He's going to, I mean, before the FOMC, he said inflation risk have come down, employment risk have increased. Honestly, I think most of them are going to repeat what Powell said with slight variation. So Hammack, we're going to find out if she's a lone dissenter whose dot showed no cuts this year. My money is on Schmidt, actually, who is not speaking, because if Hammack disagreed strongly, she would not hesitate to dissent openly as she did before. What else? Logan. Logan is important because I suspect she could hint at the end of QT, which we might find out in the minutes 3 weeks from now. And the reason I'm thinking QT is about to end is because you are starting to see signs of liquidity tightness in the Fed funds market. I mean, you see the elasticity interest rate to the quantity of reserve is starting to increase. The Fed reserve repo is gone. You look at the ratio of Fed reserves to banks' assets, it's where it was in 2018 when we started to see interest rate become responsive to the quantity of reserves. So she could hint at that.
Okay, so it seems like next week we're going to get something from Myron basically trying to explain why the Fed should do six cuts, but probably, people probably won't pay too much attention to that because it's unrealistic. Powell's probably going to say something similar to before. Hammack, we're going to find out is or is not the loan dissenter. Logan could talk on QT, and are there any others you're paying attention to?
Williams, since he's a permanent member of the FOMC, and since he owns, I mean, obviously he doesn't decide on his own, but the New York Fed, implements policies, so they are the one who monitors the market and register important things like changes in money market. So he's the one with the who could also signal that QT is about to end.
Okay, awesome. Now going over to the data on next week, I think so the standout data seems to be we've got personal income and spending, and we also have the trade balance number. So two themes going on there. Perhaps we start with personal income and spending. The big thing I can see is personal income month on month seems to be expected to slow from 50 bips to 40. Number one, is that important? And number two, is there anything else you're looking out for in those numbers?
So it is important indirectly in the sense that the forecast implies a decline in the savings rate. We'll see because the data always gets revised a little bit. But in terms of the growth outlook, the savings rate is really key because if you look at consumption and income, real consumption has been roughly flat since end of last year. There was a dip in Q1, which I suspect was residual seasonality. But if you take July, so the last data point is more or less where it was in December. And by contrast, income has really remained on the trend we had last year. So the slowdown in consumption, which is super important in the US because consumption is 70% of GDP. So the slowdown in consumption was down to an increase in the savings rate that had fallen to super low levels, basically the lowest since before the GFC. So let's see if that happens and the savings rate, if the savings rate does fall, it will be a sign that growth could be about to pick up. So we'll have to see. In my books, this is a more important part of the release.
And one part of this, and this was sort of one of the big components of your view earlier in the year, was that okay, look, households and businesses were very uncertain around the economic backdrop. Tariffs are obviously an incredibly large part of this. Do you think that would signal that perhaps they are becoming more, comfortable with this tariff backdrop, that things aren't perhaps going as bad as, everyone thought they could go?
So it's a good segue in the trade balance, but the increase in the savings rate, it was a combination of things. First, the level before the increase was probably, even by US standards, unsustainable. Then yes, economic uncertainty played a big role. And if you look at the policy uncertainty index, it's definitely come down since the highs of Liberation Day, so the big tariff announcement on April 2nd, but it's still significantly higher than before Liberation Day. So there is still a residual of anxiety on the part of the consumer. You also see that in the University of Michigan consumer confidence survey. You see, for instance, that they have an assessment of the current situation broken down by income level. And until recently, so it's by third, until recently, the third lowest income consumers were much more negative about the current situations than the middle third or the top third. Now the middle third has turned negative about the current situation as well. So that could show up in the savings rate. So we'll have to see. On the other hand, you have the equity gains, but the thing about equity holdings, it's very concentrated. I think the 10 top percent in terms of income of US household own 80% of the equity. So you really have this K-shaped recovery with a small minority of US household doing very well. The estimate is that the 10 top percent household in terms of income account for 50% of consumption, and the rest really struggling. And the savings rate, of course, is the average of the two. So we will see.
And you touched on the trade balance there and how it is a good segue. So let's jump straight into it. I mean, there seems to be two key points in this number. One, obviously, that is a point you've been talking about for a while. But the first one I wanted to start on was the effective tariff rate. Now, you've been showing this chart for a good couple of months now, where the effective tariff rate seems to be below sort of the proposed tariff rate. Are you expecting that to continue?
Yes, so based on a very plausible forecast of imports, we'll get the actual data this week. I think the tariff rate last month, the effective tariff rate was about 10%, the same as in July and June. And this compared with an announced tariff rate of about 17, 17.5%, which is a Yale Budget Lab estimate. And I think the discrepancy can no longer be seen as implementation lag. I think the discrepancy probably reflects that the administration keeps granting exemption, for instance, pharmaceutical exempted from the tariff on India. And in turn, I think this reflects the fact that voters are very unhappy. President Trump net ratings on inflation are minus 21%. The midterms are coming, and the administration implemented the tariff before its tax cut kicked in and gave additional purchasing power to household. And even in terms of additional purchasing power, it's not clear how much there really will be, because a lot of the tariff was about extending the Trump tax cut, so keeping the current policy baseline. So I suspect the 10% average effective tariff is because the administration has realized this is not helping the economy, not helping voters in the short run, and so they have quietly toned down the tariff rhetoric. So that's one data point that's going to be important in the trade balance, the actual level of import and the average effective tariff. The other data point, which is really going to be important, is capital goods imports. Everybody is focused on AI CapEx, so the Max 7 CapEx, which with good reason, because it's really huge. But a lot of that CapEx is actually imported, so doesn't have much impact on the economy. What has an impact in the CapEx, and what you see clearly, is an increase in spending on software and also the construction part of the data centers. Those have lower import components, but the equipment I'm talking in GDP terms here, they break down CapEx between construction equipment and what they called intellectual property products, including software. So the equipment part of the AI investment is highly import intensive. The elasticity of American supply of electronics capital goods is very low. So when you have a surge, as now, it's largely driven by imports, which means that the net impact on growth is actually not that huge.
So basically, if everything goes right for Trump and he manages to bring production back to the US, then maybe there's an impact one day. But for now, it's very much that the AI CapEx cycle is very much supplied from abroad. And despite CapEx being the AI CapEx cycle being absolutely massive, it's netted out on from the net import side of things.
Exactly. Basically, it's going to show up, dare I say, in the trade balance rather than in the GDP data.
And the final thing for next week, I've been hearing some headlines that there's a government shutdown on the way. Can you tell us more about that? Just what's actually going on? Will it happen? And what's your base case?
Yeah, it's a bit of a ritual or a bit of kabuki theater, if you will. So each time, actually, usually it's Republicans who shut down the government whenever they control one of the houses of Congress. They try to exact changes in fiscal policies that they like. Less deficit, more spending on the military, less spending on less social spending. This time around, it's a little different. It's Democrats who could shut down the government, which would be a first. I never pay a lot of attention because voters historically have penalized the party that shut down the government. And that's why the shutdown usually are resolved literally at the last minute of the last hour of the last day, so at midnight on September 30th. Or if the government gets shut down, it doesn't last much. I don't think this time around will be different. And also the Democrats have to be a little bit careful because the administration has been cutting down all kinds of funding programs and so on and so forth, and it could use the shutdown as an excuse to cut more of those because it actually gets to decide within certain guidelines which part of the government gets shut down. So I suspect it's going to be, as always, brinkmanship, the big innovation. This time around, is that it's the Democrats who will be doing the brinkmanship, but as usual, it will get resolved at or close to midnight, or maybe a few minutes after midnight
So
in the
basically it's just a bunch of politicians throwing their toys out the pram because they can, and the Democrats aren't stupid. They'll read the tea leaves before it's too late, and they probably won't end up shutting government down.
Well, I mean, I'm assuming that rationality will prevail, but sometimes it's a dangerous assumption.
Now, Tom, I'm not as much of a US expert as you are, that's fair to say. So, are we missing anything else for next week before we close this off?
No, these are the key issues. This is going to be my Fed speaker week. And I will update everybody on the Bloomberg chat.
Incredible. Thank you, everyone, so much for watching. And thank you, Dominique, for joining me once again.
Thank you, and good luck, everybody.